start the sixth chapter. Sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is known generally as Dhyana Yoga. Now, a precursor of this chapter was given in 5.27 and 28 by Krishna. Parshan Kutva Bahir Bhayans. Shut out all the sense objects outwards. So the fifth chapter established how, while practicing Karma Yoga, by Atma Gyan, a person can stay free from bondage, and by Paramatma Gyan, one can attain liberation. Now, Paramatma Gyan, to be attained properly, one has to eventually go beyond Karma Yoga to practice an alternative higher process, a progressive higher process. So, there are three ways one can go ahead from Karma Yoga. From Karma Yoga, one can go upwards to Gyan Yoga, Dhyana Yoga, or Bhakti Yoga. So, Krishna will explore the process of Dhyana Yoga in this chapter, and then he will explore the process of Bhakti Yoga in the next six chapters. When Krishna talks about Dhyana Yoga in this chapter, Arjuna will tell that this is not practical, and then Krishna will address that concern of Arjuna by talking about alternative process starting from 7.1. So, this is the overview of the chapter. So, Aruruksha is the beginning stage. Arudha is the situated stage. So, if you have a ladder, at the bottom of the ladder, somebody is trying to climb up the ladder. That is the Aruruksha stage. Like, you have Arohan, climbing up, moving upward. So, Aruruksha means to move up. So, when one is in the stage of moving up, that is called the Aruruksha stage. So, basically, this first set of nine verses in the chapter describe how the seeker moves upwards on the ladder. So, it describes the perfect stage, Arudha also. Then, after giving an outline of this process, Krishna goes into the details of the practices that are to be adopted by which one can attain that destination. So, that means how one can move from Aruruksha to Arudha ultimately. And in Arudha one can go towards Samadhi. That's what Krishna talks about. So, now when Krishna talks about the sadhana, then he talks about it in three successive ladders. The flow of the chapter from verses 10 to 32 is not one ladder which moves upwards to the top. It's rather like a ladder which moves up to the top, then again it starts, again it moves up, again it stops, again it moves up. So, Krishna does that as he is giving progressively higher realizations of the Absolute Truth. And he also gives glimpses of the perfection and also talks about the process to the perfections, alternating them so that the perception of the perfection doesn't appear too lofty. And one also remembers that there's a practice by which one can attain perfection. So the distinctive characteristic of this chapter is that this is the only chapter in the Bhagavad Gita that talks elaborately about sadhana. There are other chapters also which talk about it, but elaborately this is a chapter which talks about sadhana. And it talks about sadhana primarily in terms of dealing with the mind. So we can get very many valuable verses about how to deal with the troublesome mind in this chapter. And these insights are helpful even for our chanting. Because that is the time when we have to confront the mind directly face to face. So, after Krishna has described the sadhana in detail for almost 33 verses, Arjuna has his doubts. And his doubts take the form of two questions. So, first question is, this process seems impractical. And Krishna doesn't reject the process. He says, yes, it is difficult. It's difficult, no doubt. But it is difficult to control the mind. Actually, what Krishna says is, this process is difficult, doesn't seem practical because to control the mind is very difficult. So Arjuna agrees. So Krishna agrees, says controlling the mind is difficult. But if you have the right process, you can do it. And what that right process is, Krishna doesn't talk about explicitly in this chapter. Then Arjuna asks a second question, fine, it may be that by a right process one can attain perfection. But what if one is not able to attain the perfection in this life? either because one dies prematurely, one dies before attaining perfection, or because one gives up the path before one has attained perfection. What will happen? And Krishna addresses that question in verses 38 to 45. 38 to 40 is the question of Arjuna, three verses question. And 41 to 45 is Arjuna's question being answered by Krishna. And Krishna gives a summary of what he has talked about till now, specifically in this chapter, and overall in the first section of the Bhagavad Gita, in verses 46 and 47. So 46 he talks about become a yogi, and then he talks about in 47 who is the best yogi, one who fixes his mind on me. So this is the overview of the chapter. Let us start with the verses. So if you are writing it, you can write it down. We can look at the Bhagavad Gita. Sri Bhagavan Vacha.
Sri Bhagavan Vacha.
Anashita karma phalam.
Anashita karma phalam.
Karyam karma karoti yah.
Karyam karma karoti yah.
Sasanyasi cha yogi cha.
Sasanyasi cha yogi cha.
Nanirajnirna chakriyah.
Nanirajnirna chakriyah.
So, anashita karma phalam. So, one who does not take shelter of the fruits of karma. I discussed in one of the earlier classes how materialistic people take shelter of the fruits of karma. It means if a person, if a sports star is working very hard, sportsman is working very hard, practicing and doing all the exercises, and then his dream is, one day I will hold aloft the gold medal. And that dream makes him keep going onwards. So actually, materialistic people take ashraya of the phala to keep doing the karma. Chances don't do that. Anashita karma phalam. Karyam karma karoti ha. So there are three words starting from ka in this, but all of them are different. Karma is action, karoti is to do, and karyam is prescribed duty. So do the work as per your prescribed duty. Karyam in our normal conversation, Hindi or Marathi, refers to just action. But in Sanskrit, karyam refers to duty, prescribed duty, or like obligated duty, obligation. Sa sannyasi cha yogi cha. Such a person is both the sannyasi and the yogi. That means he is both. Now, Krishna has explicitly equated the two in one person. Earlier, Krishna had said that actually both paths are equal. Remember at the start of the fifth chapter, 5.23, he said that actually those who think that these two paths are different, 5.34, he says that no, they are not, because they are prithak balaha. So wise people don't think like that. So Krishna is saying, actually both of them are same path. Now Krishna has done something deeper and he's saying actually the person who works without taking shelter of the fruits is both a sannyasi and a yogi. So here, if you know the dichotomy is yogi, generally we might think of yogi as a person who is yogasanas, a person who is practicing the path of Ashtanga Yoga. In general, Bhagavad Gita refers to yogi, at least till now, as a person who is doing Karma Yoga. So, yogi here refers to one who does action, and sannyasi refers to one who renounces action. So, Krishna is telling you, one who works without taking shelter of the fruits. So, sannyasi, cha yogi, cha, which a person is sannyasi and a yogi. And what is this referring to if there is any ambiguity? Na niragnir na chakriyah. That not one who does not light a fire and does not do any activity. So, agni refers to the daily sacrifices like agnihotra, yotishtoma. There are some sacrifices which are to be performed by especially the Brahmins every day. And even the Kshatriyas have the sacrificial fire that is going on constantly. So, one who does not light a fire means one who has renounced the world. So Krishna is saying one who physically renounces the world, giving up the duty of the fire sacrifice or the various activities, kriya, such a person is not a sannyasi or a yogi. So Krishna is quite emphatic as far as he is starting the verse. Nandiragnir na chakriyaha. Now Krishna will describe in the next section, next verse. So Prabhupada, Prabhupada quotes about how the sannyasi and yogi are equivalent. And he explained that the sannyasi yogi are manifested in their fullest form in a bhakta. And Prabhupada quotes Nananam Janana Sundarim over here. How the person does not, so if Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prayer does not focus so much on what a person is doing, whether he's renouncing the world or is engaging in the world. In fact, what he says is that I'm ready to take birth again in this world also, but I want only your service. I want nothing else. So that is so Prabhupada is a perfect sannyasi or perfect yogi. Yam sannyasamiti prahur.
Yam sannyasamiti prahur.
Yogam tam vidhi pandava.
Yogam tam vidhi pandava.
Naya sannyasta sankalpo.
Naya sannyasta sankalpo.
Yogi bhavati kashchana.
Yogi bhavati kashchana.
So yam sannyasam iti prahur. Prahur means to be said. That which is said to be sannyas, O Krishna, O Arjuna, that is also, you should know, to be yoga. So, sannyas and yoga are the same. So, the previous verse equated the two in a person. Now, Krishna, this verse is equating the two in parts once again. And what is the basis for the equalization? Na ya asanyasta sankalpo. Sankalpa is the desire for material enjoyment. Na ya
asti sarve samarabha
kama sankalpa varjitaha. In 4.9, Krishna talked about how the Ishkam Karma Yogi has to give up all sankalpa. Sankalpa means the desire for enjoyment. Na ya asanyasta sankalpo. One who has not renounced sankalpa, one who has not renounced the desire for material enjoyment, one such a person cannot be a yogi. He certainly, kashchana means certainly, he cannot be a yogi. Yogi bhavati kashchana. So let us look at this. These two verses seem similar, but there is some difference between the two. So we have 6.1 and 6.2. So 6.1 is saying, same person is sannyasi and yogi. So it is talking about equivalent. Okay. And 6.2 is talking about sannyas and yoga. Require a common denominator. What is the common denominator? That is sannyasta sankalpo. And same person, what is the criteria when he becomes a kanyasi and yogi? Anashrutaha karma phalam. Karma phalam. Has a focus on person, 6.2 has a focus on path. But essentially, the factor is one should be detached. So, the 6.1 is affirmative. If such a person is indeed a sannyasi and yogi, who is detached. And 6.2 is negative. If a person doesn't have this, he cannot be a sannyasi and he cannot be a yogi also. Although if you just read the two verses, they may seem to be saying the same thing. It's an affirmative assertion and this is a negative assertion. So this way basically the verses are saying the same thing but in different ways. And what is the common thing they are saying? That one has to be detached. Anashuddha karma phalam sannyasta sankalpo. Now Krishna will describe in the next verse what is the stage that needs to be attained to move forward in the path of yoga. ఆరురుక్షోర్మునేర్యోగం
కర్మకారణముచ్యతే
యోగారూఢస్య తస్యైవ శమః కారణముచ్యతే. So now naturally here, after hearing the first two verses, the question comes up. But then is there nothing like sannyas at all? Is there nothing like sannyas at all? Because you are saying that a person who is doing karma himself sannyasi. But we see that there is an ashram called sannyas. There are people who are sannyasis. So if you are saying, Krishna, that actually the karma yoga itself is sannyasi, then what about those who are actually physically also renounced the world? What about them? So Krishna describes that actually that is at a particular level of spiritual advancement. So aruruksha is the practice, is the seeker stage. So when one is in the aruruksha stage, karma karana muchyate. So here karana, generally speaking, we use in Hindi or Marathi karana to mean the cause. But in Sanskrit, karana means the means, not the cause, but the tools. Karma karana muchyate. Karma is the means for advancement. Or you can put it another way as karma is the cause of advancement. But it is not, that means karma is the sadhan that is used for advancement. There is a verse in the 13th chapter which is Purusha sukha dukkhanam bhoktutve heturuchyate karya karana kartutve. It's a very confusing verse, 13.21. That is repeated in the Srimad Bhagavatam also almost identically. So that will come to the significance of these words hetu and karana over there. So aruruksho munir yogam. So when the muni or the yogi muni is at the aruruksha stage, aruruksha is the beginning stage, for him he should do work, and by work he will make advancement. And when he becomes arud, when he becomes well situated, at that time shamaha, he should give up work. So Krishna now acknowledges Arjuna's point. Yes, there is a level when one should renounce the world. And at that time, shamaha, giving up activity, is the means of advancement. So now, when is this? Okay, where is it? Huh? Yoga aruruksha and arudha. So we know Ashtanga Yoga has these 8 stages. So the first 4 stages are said to be the aruruksha stage. And the last 4 are said to be the arudha stage. So the first 4 can be practiced even without renouncing the world. Yam, Niyam, Asan, Pranayam can be practiced even by a person who is a householder. Even a person who is engaged in the world. Now, Srila Prabhupada says, we'll see later on, he will say that actually, to practice yoga, one has to go out into the forest. One cannot stay at home. He's talking about yoga as a path for spiritual perfection. Yoga cannot give us spiritual perfection if one is staying in the house. Eventually, one has to go to Pratyaha, Dhyan, Dharana, Samadhi. So Pratyaha cannot be done in the householder life. Because Pratyaha is shutting out all the sense objects. So, if one stays in the house, practically the sense objects shut out all thought of transcendence. Isn't it? Very difficult to shut out the sense objects. Even if they don't shut out, the sense objects and the worldly concerns occupy a substantial amount of time and a substantial area of one's consciousness. So therefore, from Pratyahara onwards, one has to renounce the world. So, Aruruksha Munir Yogam Karma Karana Muchyate. That means one is an Aruruksha. When you are still in the seeker stage, preliminary seeker stage, person is practicing Yam, Niyam, Asana, Pranayam, work, do your prescribed duty also. When one decides to start practicing Pratyahara, Dhyan, Dharana, Samadhi, at that time, one can go out of the world, renounce the world and practice in action. Shamaha karana muchyate. Now how will I know that now I have come to a level where I can start practicing Pratyahara? Now anybody can say I will shut out the sense objects. But no. To be able to shut out the sense objects, there has to be a certain level of advancement, a certain level of deep detachment. And when one can do Shamaha, that Krishna will describe in the next verse. So when one can renounce the world, Krishna describes in the next verse now. Yada hinendriyartheshu
Yada hinendriyartheshu
Nakarmashvanu sajjate
Nakarmashvanu sajjate
Sarva-sankalpa-sanyasi.
Yoga-rudhastad-ucchate.
Yadahi na indriyartheshu. So, one has no attraction to the sense objects. Na yadahi na indriyartheshu. Na karmasva anusajyate. So one doesn't work for the sense objects, one is not attached to karma, one does not have material desires. Such a person is yoga-arudha. He is situated in a way that he can practice spiritual life. Yoga-arudha-stadocchati. You see the pen is there inside. One of the drawers might be there. Right. Now this verse can refer either to the yoga-arudha stage beginning, or it can also refer to the yoga-arudha end, because yoga-arudha is actually a process where all these three deepen. Now what is Prabhupada telling in this translation? If you say, having renounced all material desires. So Baldev Vidyavachan underscores the point that Krishna is telling sarva sankalpa sanyasi. Krishna is not telling sarva karma sanyasi. He should give up all desires, not all actions. What is the meaning of this? That a person can very easily give up actions, but to give up desires is not easy. So till one has not given up desires, one should not give up the actions. And when one has become, doing the actions, one has, doing karma, one has realized actually there is nothing substantial in this world. The desire fades. Then one can give up the actions. A sarva sankalpa sannyasi is important for the person to be situated in arudha stage. So this is talking about three things. One, so indriyartheshu means one does not engage in sense gratification. Karmasma means one does not do work to get future sense gratification. And sarva sankalpa sannyasi means one does not desire sense gratification. So these are three different things that are being talked about in this verse. I'll explain this here. So actually sense gratification has three phases. One is desiring, engaging, pursuing. I desire sense gratification. So, in the mind, a person is contemplating. I will enjoy. Engaging. That means, okay, I engage in sense gratification. Right now, I do sense gratification. Third is pursuing. That means, I have to make some arrangements. Okay, I have to get sense. I want to eat this delicious food. I have to earn money for that. So, I go and get a job for that. So, I am pursuing sense gratification. There are three different aspects of sense gratification. And Krishna is saying, all these three one has to give up. So desiring, Krishna is telling in 6.4c, sarva sankalpa sanyasi. That means I should give up the desires. Engaging is indriyarth. Vidahi na indriyartheshu. And pursuing is na karmasva anusajjate. It is anushajyate. This is 6.4. The karma is anushajyate. So there are three characteristics of yoga-arudha. So not only do we not pursue or engage or even desire sense gratification. So it's quite a tall order, isn't it? You think of it this way. Maybe to some extent we have stopped pursuing, and to some extent we have stopped engaging. But to stop desiring is quite difficult. And that happens.
Engages in fruitive activity.
Fruitive activity means it's for pursuing sense gratification. Fruitive activity generally refers to the pursuit of sense gratification, the activity that will eventually give the fruit of sense gratification. Kamatma swargapara janma karma phalapradam kriya vishesha bahulam bhogaishwaryagatim prati. So in the second chapter, I think 42nd, 43rd verses, he's talking about the karma kandis who desire swarga. So they do these activities for swargapara janma karma phalapradam. The phala that they want from that is janma and karma. So fruitive activities are not themselves directly sense gratification. In fact, fruitive activities involve sometimes giving up sense gratification. For example, when a person who is doing yagya, who is hosting the sacrifices, at that time often he has to follow strict rules. So he cannot eat at any time during the whole pack sacrifice of yagya. There is a sacrifice, he should not eat anything. In fact, when it is described that Maharaj Anga was performing the yagya and the brahmanas were offering ahuti, but nobody, the devatas were not coming to accept the ahuti. So the brahmana said, we are doing everything perfectly, but devatas are not coming. So then he was disturbed, but then he asked the brahmana's permission, can I speak? So yes, you can speak. And then he asked all the, there were priests and there were other brahmins, elderly brahmins and other learned persons. He said, please tell me, if any of you can tell, what is the cause of the brahmana, the devatas are not coming? Have I committed some offense? And then they told him, actually there is not a single offense that you have committed in this life. But because of offense from a past life, you don't have a son. And because you don't have a son, so because of that stain, the devatas are not coming. So you perform a yagya, satisfy the Supreme Lord. And by that, you will get a son. And then when you do the sacrifices, the Supreme Lord also comes. If you get a son also, devatas will also come. Because when the Supreme Lord comes, Yajneshwar comes, other devatas will also come. So the point I'm making is, the Yajaman is also expected to practice Mauna Vrata. So what to speak of engaging in sense gratification. So fruitive activities often mean require giving up sense gratification. Now many people in India do some sort of strict fasting during Shravan Mas. They may give up meat, or they may stop, they may not wear chappals. They do a lot of things like that. They don't shave. Of course, I think that is more of a, is that austerity for people? I don't know. Maybe it is. It is just a fashion statement for many people also. But whatever it is, yeah, people do that. So often fruitive activities are themselves not sense gratificatory. They are meant for the purpose of sense gratification. Okay. So now, what is the main challenge in coming to this? Why is it that one cannot become yoga ruler prematurely? Why can one not adopt shamaha, the giving up action, prematurely? That is because the mind is not disciplined. So essentially what the seeker has to do is deal with the mind. So after talking about the Aruruksha and Arudha and describing the characters of Arudha, how will one come to the yoga ruler stage? That is by disciplining the mind. And that's why Krishna shifts the focus, the next set of verses, on the mind. So essentially, the journey from Aruruksha to Arudha is not a physical journey. It is an internal journey. And what changes along the journey is the ability to control the mind. The more one controls the mind, the more one is moving forward in the spiritual path. So then Krishna will describe briefly the nature of the mind, and he will hint at the process of controlling the mind. He doesn't go into the details of the process. He more describes the result of the process than the practices of the process, than the details of the process.
Uddharedātmanātmānam
Nātmānam avasādaye
Ātmaivayātmanobandhu
Ātmaivāripurātmanah So uddharet ātmanātmānam. So now Shankaracharya translates this as all the Atma, he refers to the soul itself. So the self, he uses the word self over there. But the self should elevate the self with the self and should not degrade the self with the self, because the self is the friend of the self and the self is the enemy of the self. So what is the self?
Because it's so confusing to understand. So Prabhupada makes things simple by telling that one Atma refers to the soul, the other Atma refers to the mind.
Now, some impersonalist philosophers use the phrase lower self and higher self. And some ISKCON devotees also use that. Prabhupada never used this phraseology of lower self and higher self, because there is only one self. There are not two selves. But it is, if we understand the philosophical context, the lower self can refer to the mind and the higher self can refer to the intelligence. The lower self can refer to our lower demoniac nature. The higher self can refer to the divine nature. And the two are in conflict. So if we use it in that context, so then when you are using the word lower self and higher self, we are using it more in a metaphorical than a literal sense. There are literally no two selves. There is only one self. So sometimes the verse 3.43 is translated, conquer the lower self with the higher self. Evam buddhe param buddhva samstapya atmanam atma. Conquer the lower self with the higher self. So this is a metaphorical use of the self. And the lower self will refer to the mind, the subtle body. The higher self will refer either to the intelligence, or it can refer directly to the soul also, depending on what is being referred to. So generally, Srila Prabhupada avoids most metaphorical usages. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those uses are banned. Because previous acharyas used that. I think either Vishnu Chakravarti or Baldev Devaki translate this verse same as Shankaracharya.
I think Chakravarti Pada translate the same way.
This is the self should elevate the self with the self and not degrade the self with the self. And Baldev Devaki translates that self, one of the selves, as the mind. So that is fine. So the word Atma can refer to the soul. Atma can refer to the mind also. So when we talk about here, Krishna is telling one should elevate the Atma by the Atma. So what does that mean? That would mean that actually one has to use one's willpower to lift oneself. So you say, rise yourself by yourself. Some child has fallen down. The child says, Mommy, you lift me up. Says, no, get up yourself. So you should lift yourself up. Because Krishna has not yet introduced bhakti over here, so Krishna is telling, you should elevate yourself. So that is one way of understanding. And that's a valid understanding. And we should elevate yourself. But other way is, what Srila Prabhupada uses over here, that actually, I am the soul here, and here is my mind. And the mind is always proposing nonsense to me. So if I listen to the mind, then I start doing nonsense. But I make the mind listen to me. Then the mind slowly starts seeing sense, and starts becoming well-behaved. So this is relatively simpler to understand. And Prabhupada explains that one should elevate the mind and not degrade the mind. One should elevate himself with the help of his mind. Because ultimately, we cannot give up our mind. The mind is going to be there with us. So either we control the mind and we direct it properly, or we let the mind control us and we get misdirected improperly. So these are two trajectories for us. So Prabhupada is saying we should learn to use, ultimately even as I have to control the mind. But even after controlling the mind, I have to use the mind. Because as long as I am in the world, even when I have to think, I just think of Krishna. Krishna says, man mana bhava. So how do I think of him? With the mind only. So ultimately, I cannot just throw aside the mind. Sometimes I neglect the mind. That's fine. We have to neglect the mind when the mind has some undesirable tendencies which we have to neglect. So here, before we understand this verse, I'd like to explain one concept. Yesterday, were any of you there for the Sunday feast?
Yes.
Yeah. So after that, there was this question when devotee was asking about lust. Now, what exactly is the mind? Anand Sindhu was asking. Where do the emotions, do they come from the mind or do they come from the soul? So we had a long question answer after that. In fact, I put that, it was a 45 minute question answer which we had afterwards, which I put on my site also. But I will keep it simple over here. So essentially, he didn't express the question properly over there. What he was asking is lust an entity separate from us? Okay, I'll put it this way. And this principle applies to all the anarthas. What is lust? So, is it an entity separate from us, or is it just our own misdirected desire? That means, is there something called lust inside, existing inside the mind, Or is it just when I start desiring a sense object? So it's my own desire that is lust. So is the question clear here? So is there something separate from me that is existing called lust? Or is it just my own misdirected desire? Actually, the answer is both. The answer is both. How is that? If we see, Krishna describes in 3.14 that Indriyani Mano Buddhir Asyadhishthana Muchyate. He says that this lust exists in the senses, the mind and the intelligence. So now, ultimately, the soul is different. And the soul's desiring capacity exists in the soul. It will be directed to the mind, sense, and intelligence. So Krishna talks about lust as residing in particular places. And then he also says, Jahil Shatru Mahabaho. So he uses karma also to refer to our desires. Don't become lusty. So lust is also a distortion of our desire. So I'll explain this now. He uses the word to refer to our own desire and actually, in fact, this whole section, 3.38 to 30, 40, when Krishna is referring to lust, he's actually referring to it in terms of an entity that covers. He says, the covering on the womb, the covering of the womb on the embryo, the covering of dust on a mirror, the covering of smoke on fire. So that would indicate that there is something that is there originally and something that is covering. So now the covering is different from the original object, isn't it? So now what is the original object? That is the soul. And the covering is the lust. So now we know the soul is covered by the subtle body. So lust exists within the subtle body. Okay. Now if lust exists within the subtle body, then Krishna uses also the word karma in terms of desire. You desire something, don't desire something. So that means, can you think of any verse where Krishna uses the word karma in terms of desiring something, not in terms of separate entity, but in terms of desiring something? Kama atmana swarga para. Okay, that is figurative use. His atma is made of kama. Kama atmana. He's filled with material desires. But when Krishna says that, Atharva sarva kamo yajet. Atharva uses the word sarva swarga kamo yajet. And one who wants swarga, he performs yajna. Standard phrase in the Atharvaveda comes. So in Bhagavad Gita we have, one is free from kama and krodha. That could refer to that he is free from the covering of the entity also. Isn't it? That this particular covering is removed. Could refer to that. There are many verses which talk about it like this. When Arjuna is asking the question, Atha kena prayuktoyam papam charati purusha, Krishna is answering, kamesha krodesha. So now it is pushing us towards action. This also would indicate that there is something separate. There is something separate which is existing and which is causing us to act. So at the same, now when Krishna says Arjuna that you should become nishkama, for example 2.70, one, what does he say? The verse after Apuryamanam. Vihaya kamanya sarvan pumam sharati nispruha nirmamo nirahamkara sajanti vadek nispruha nirkam nishkama. He says, become free from kama and act. So, that means here Krishna is telling that you should give up the desire and act. So, we will see that the word kama, I can't think of a verse in Bhagavad Gita right now specifically, but no, it is talking about avaran. Avratam jnana metin. Okay, you have got the index there. Okay, I'll find out a verse. But there are many verses like that. I just thought of this one from Atharveda. But there are many verses in the Bhagavad Gita also. Basically, kama refers to our desire. It's natural. Somebody is desiring something. Kama naam we use in Hindi also. So to desire something. So now, how does this work? Etavaditi nishchitaha. Yes, very good verse. Kamopa bhoga parmaya. They are certain that actually the enjoyment of sense gratification is the is what they want. Kama krodha parayana, that section also comes, 16.11.12. That kama, they are completely dedicated to fulfilling the desire of kama and krodha. So now what does this mean? That here there is the original soul, and then there is the covering of the soul, the filter. So for example, there is the white light, and it's covered with a reddish filter, reddish film. Then that red light, that what will come out of it will be a reddish light. So the same light which was a soothing white earlier becomes a jarring red afterwards. So now kama can refer to both the red film and the red light that comes out. It can refer to both. So when we say that we should control our senses, that means don't let the red light come out. Don't let the red light come out. Okay, that means these desires are there, but I don't let the desires express themselves. But that means you purify yourself. That means what? Remove the red film entirely. Remove the red film entirely. So, essentially, lust is both the covering on our consciousness and it is the desire that comes out through the covering of the consciousness. So now, initially what we do is, we don't let that desire express itself too much. And eventually, we remove the covering itself. So what is this covering? That covering is like is a kind of programming. That covering makes us desire in a particular way. Or rather, that covering changes our desires in a particular way. The original soul's desire to love and serve Krishna, like the white light of the tube, when it passes through lust, so lust is like a, you remember I talked about the mind is like a program. The mind is like a software program. So now the mind itself is a program, so you could call the mind like in a computer the operating system. But other than the operating system, you know, you can have different internet browsers. You can have Internet Explorer, you can have Mozilla, you can have Chrome, you can have you can have Opera, whatever. So these are all different programs which are there within or above, which exist above the foundation of the main program, that is the operating system. The operating system, it may technically may not use the word program, but the point is it's a software. It's a software. So it's like layering of softwares. So within the mind, which is like the operating system, which is also one kind of software, there is lust, which is another kind of software. And then this lust makes us desire in particular ways. So now there are certain programs which come innate. For example, as soon as we get a body, in that body lust is there. Gradually it will express itself. A child may not be able to express lust, but an older person expresses lust. But there are certain programs which we get by association. Lust, to become lusty is more or less natural for all living beings. But say to become mad about cricket, that is not a natural program. That is an acquired program, isn't it? So, in India, people become mad after cricket. In Europe, people become mad after football. In America, people become mad after baseball or rugby or whatever. So, that is an acquired program. So, the acquired programs are easier to delete. But the innate programs that are there, they take more time to delete. But the point is that actually, once we start getting that program, then our desires naturally get transformed in that way. So now what happens is, the more I run the program, the more it becomes like the default. So initially, a person had no attraction to cricket, he just sees cricket, what is happening? Yes, waste of time. But then, a person gets excited, attached, the more he runs the program, and the mind, this is a square cut, this is this, this is a hole, this is this, this is that. And then even before the match starts, person's mind is wild with anticipation. What is happening? The desire is getting filtered through that. So purification means, first we stop letting the desire go through that and expressing itself and through that program. And second is, we just delete the program itself. We shut the program itself. So, what is the context over here? When Krishna is telling, you should control udhare atmana atmanam na atmanam avasadayet. So basically here Krishna is talking about, let's for the timing. Is this point clear about the program and multi-level programs that are there? Okay. Clear or no? Okay. So now, so those of you don't, may not be from computer background, they might find it a little difficult. But I think everybody knows a little bit of computers. And
the important thing is to know, to become free from lust. Not necessarily know how lust works.
There can be people who become free from it by surrendering to Krishna without knowing about it also. And there can be others who can know everything about it and still fall prey to it. So, ultimately, analysis can be a tool for purification. But analysis itself is not necessarily equivalent to purification. Analytical ability does not necessarily mean purity. They are two different things entirely.
We will take Prabhupada's translation. We will not go to elevate the soul by the soul. That's a little complex. Let's keep. There is the mind and there is the soul over here. So, Uddhare Atmanatmanam. So, one should elevate oneself with his mind. Uddhare Atmana Atmanam. Elevate the mind. Elevate oneself with the mind. What does that mean? That means, actually for us, at our stage, the mind has to be the instrument of thought and action. Without the mind, we can neither think nor act. So therefore, Uddhare Atmanatmanam means use the mind to think and act in a beneficial. Natmanam avasadayat. So don't degrade yourself with the mind. That means, now within the mind, now here when Krishna is using the mind, it's more in a generic sense. So the mind can be the friend, the mind can be any. That means within the mind, there are beneficial programs and there are harmful programs. So, for example, we may have some attraction to some aspects of devotional service. We may have some attraction to devotees. Some limb of devotional service we may have attached. So, that is like a beneficial program. And we may still have some residual material attachment. So, that is like a harmful program. So, Krishna is saying that the mind is the friend and the mind the enemy also. So, what does that mean? That within the mind itself, there are certain tendencies which are friendly, which are beneficial, and there are certain tendencies which are harmful. So we need to nourish the tendencies which are beneficial and suppress the tendencies that are harmful. So Krishna will make this more explicit in the next verse. I'll discuss more about this verse, this purport, when we complete the next verse.
Banduratmaatmanastasya Banduratmaatmanastasya
Yenatmaimatmanajita
Yenatmaimatmanajita
Anatmanastu shatrutve
Anatmanastu shatrutve
Vartetatmaiva shatruvat
Vartetatmaiva shatruvat
Tasya of such a person Bandhur atmaatmanasya Atmaatman. So the Atma, the mind is the friend of such a person who has conquered the mind. That means that person doesn't let the default programs of the mind run by themselves without control. He controls them and he guides the mind according to his will. Yenatmaivatmanajita Anatmanastu shatrutve. But when you not control the mind, for him, the mind is a shatru. And varte atmaiva shatruvat. Because shatruvat means he has a normal tendency to be like a shatru. Vat means like. Normal tendency to be like a shatru. So by default, the mind will be an enemy. But gradually, by purification, you can make it into a friend. So now Prabhupada quotes here from the, I think, Amrut Purushabodhini Upanishad, Amrut Bindu Upanishad. So he says that manaeva manushyana karanam bandha mokshayo. Bandhaya Vishana Sango Mukti Nirvishayamana. So Krishna is only telling her the mind can be the friend, mind can be the enemy. But Prabhupada quotes another Shruti to explain when the mind is the friend and when the mind is the enemy. So the attached mind is the enemy, the detached mind is the friend. The attached mind means that which has its own default programs for sense living going on, that is the enemy. The detached mind means its default programs are stopped. It does not have its own agenda, its own business. It is ready to listen to what we will tell it. A detached mind is a friend. So now, in the next purport, Srila Prabhupada continues this theme. Sometimes, when the verses are connected, if you look at Prabhupada's purport doesn't seem to be related with that verse directly. Actually, what Srila Prabhupada is doing is, he is simply continuing the previous purport and the next purport. You will see this in many places. So if we can't find a connection between the purport and the verse, we need to look for a connection between that purport and the previous purport. So now in the next purport, Prabhupada says that ultimately the soul's position is to be a servant. So either the soul has to obey Krishna or the soul has to obey the anarthas. That means there is a default program within us. Now if we don't want to run the default program, we have to run some other program. And the other program is the program given by Krishna. It comes through Guru Sadhu Shastra. So, Prabhupada explained that we always have to be the servant. Constitutional position of the living entity is to carry out the order of the superior. So, ultimately Prabhupada explained that the perfection of yoga will be that when one connects with the super soul in the heart and carries out the direction. But a devotee, even before that, is carrying out the direction of Krishna. That's why the devotee is also a perfect yogi. So here, so if we wish to disobey the mind, we must obey Krishna. We must obey Krishna. And if we don't obey Krishna, we will have to obey the mind. We don't have any alternative apart from these two. So, we have these two alternatives. Some program has to run. So either we take the program from Guru Sadhu Shastra or we take the program from the mind. And the mind means the program that is there within it because of the past samskaras. And that program will cause our degradation. So this is 6.6 Krishna is talking about. Now, after describing that, okay, the mind is the enemy, one has to control it. Then in the next verse Krishna will describe, how do I know if I have controlled the mind? What is the symptom of somebody who has controlled the mind? So we'll discuss this first, and if there are any questions, you can take them. Jitatmanah prashantasya.
Jitatmanah prashantasya.
Paramatma samahitah.
Paramatma samahitah.
Shitoshna sukha dukheshu.
Shitoshna sukha dukheshu.
So here, Krishna is describing three kinds of equality. Equality at the physical level, equality at the mental level, equality at the egoistic level. The more precise word would be equanimity. Equanimity means to be undisturbed, to be equipoised. So, Sheet Ushna Sukha Dukheshu. Sheet Ushna is at what level? Yeah, it's at the bodily or sensual level, physical level. Then, Sukha Dukha is at what level? It's the mental level. Man Apaman is? It is egoistic level. So these are all the levels of covering on the soul. And one has transcended all these. Shitoshna sukha dukkeshu tatha mana apamanayo. Jitatmanah prashantasya. So Krishna described, one has conquered the mind, what is his characteristic? It's prashanta, he's peaceful. Krishna will use this word prashanta two more times in the Bhagavad Gita. We'll discuss about the word more when he talks about it. In this chapter itself, twice it will come. Sa paramatma samahitaha. If you have conquered the mind, Krishna is giving an amazing assurance. He says, you actually is the paramatma. So now, this is the only occurrence in the Bhagavad Gita of the word paramatma as a composite. Paramatma as a composite. There are many references to the super soul. Paramapurusha will come, Purushottama will come. But the composite word, paramatma doesn't come many times. The super soul is already reached. What does it mean? That actually speaking, this soul is here, the super soul is here, right next to each other. But there is something which makes the soul blind and deaf to the super soul's presence. So we can't see the super soul, we can't hear the super soul. So we are blind and deaf to his presence. And what causes this wall that is blinding and deafening is actually the subtle body. Primarily the mind. The mind misdirects our consciousness away from Krishna, from the super soul. So externally, when we try to focus on Krishna, the mind distracts us there also. And internally, we can't connect with Krishna and the Super Soul because of the mind. So when the mind is conquered, then one will be, it's as good as having reached the Super Soul. Paramatma Samahitaha. And this is, okay, internally the mind becomes peaceful, one gets connected with Super Soul, and that connection with the Super Soul manifests externally as equanimity. Once one has got the inner treasure, then the worldly ups and downs don't matter much of us. Person stays peaceful. So that is one level of perfection. Now, this Jitatmana Prashantasya, the characteristics of this will be expanded in the next two verses also. So the characteristic of a person with controlled mind, it is not just that he is poised towards physical, mental, egoistic phenomena. This verse will be elaborated in the next two verses. Any questions?
Our mind knows both the things, like it's attracted to sense gratification, it knows it's wrong. And so what gives it strength or weakness to like still go towards it? Like when we know this is against Krishna consciousness, still we know both the options. Still, what gives us strength to?
What gives us strength to go towards the sense objects? It is the momentum of our past samskaras. Our past samskaras, because we have acted in that particular way. So just like if a train has been moving for a long time, then even if the brake is put on it, so the train will keep moving. So like that, we have acted towards sense gratification in this lifetime as well as in the previous lifetime. So that momentum is there. So now we are trying to stop the momentum. We are trying to press a brake. But still the default momentum keeps making it move in that direction. That's why there is the consciousness, awareness. What does Shankaracharya say? Kama krodhas tatha lobhas. No. Kama krodha lobhascha dehe tishtati taskara. Kama krodhas tatha lobhas dehe tishtati taskara. Jnanaratna apaharaya tasmat jagur jagat. Because these are default tendencies which will steal away our knowledge. Therefore, be aware. So actually it's our own past conditionings. It's like a program. Both programs are there. But it's a program that we are used again and again and again. That's why it's become like a default program. So we have to resist it. And then it will subside. So, question? One last question.
Many times you are equating krodha with frustration. Krodha with frustration.
I'm equating. See, the Bhagavad Gita doesn't contain any specific word for frustration as far as I know it. And in one sense, frustration is suppressed anger. So when I don't express my anger, then that becomes frustration. So when I express the anger, that becomes generally explosion. I shout at somebody. So that's why it's more or less equivalent. Thank you. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Prema. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.